This is Scott Becker with a special episode of the Becker Group Women's Leadership Podcast plus the Scott Becker Business Podcast. We've got two fascinating professors with us today. One is Brad Johnson, who's a professor at the U.S. Naval Academy. Second is Dave Smith, who's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. And they've written together a fascinating book, Good Guys, How We Can Be Better Allies to Women in the Workplace. And thus, even though both are male and professors and with the Navy, we're on the Becker Group Women's Leadership Podcast today. Thrilled to have them with us. Brad, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Certainly, Scott. I'm delighted to be with you today. I am a clinical psychologist and a professor at Annapolis and also in the graduate school at Johns Hopkins, and I have spent most of my career researching and writing about terrific mentoring relationships, and then my colleague Dave came along and we began collaborating around how men can be better as mentors and sponsors, and now more recently as allies with women at work.
Yeah, this is Dave, and I'm a sociologist. I do all my research in the area of gender, work, and family, so looking at gendered perspectives of careers and family. I spent 30 years as a Navy pilot before becoming an academic, and then my last few years I was at the Naval Academy teaching with Brad. So that's where we became friends and colleagues and started our work together in the writing of these books.
So fascinating, and I guess I start with Brad and Dave, and Brad, I'll ask you this first. I mean, it seems ironic that a great book comes out of, and maybe my irony is probably misplaced, around two leaders who you think come from like what's considered a very machismo institution, the U.S. Navy. And both of you, notwithstanding that background, have become particularly interested in women's leadership and how men become better allies to women. And Brad, let me ask you to kick this off. How did that come to be? How did this become a defining interest for the two of you?
Yeah, it's a really important question, Scott, and you're probably not surprised. Dave and I get that quite a bit. So, for me, and I think, I would say many men, the motivations are both, business, academic, and personal, and I think both of those motivations are often really salient for a lot of guys. So, on the research side, for years I mentioned I've been looking at the mentoring research, and one thing I see consistently is evidence showing that women don't get as much mentorship in the workplace. They don't get the same quality of mentoring, and then quite often the sponsorship piece is missing from mentoring for women. And I've been aware of this literature for years and always wondered what is keeping men, especially in male-centric organizations, from mentoring women. And so that was the research motivation. The personal motivation has been watching women like my only sibling, my sister, who has entered the same profession I have, but has often faced gendered headwinds, time after time that I have never encountered. And, just watching what my sister has gone through, I think has increased my empathy for the experience of women in the workplace. So I would say both of those really kind of got me into this space.
Yeah. And then this is Dave. And I think that, for me, it a lot of it started my wife is a retired naval officer as well, and so I certainly saw her experiences up close and personal, and the differences in how there in the military in particular, there's lots of structural difference in terms of careers and what people could do and what they couldn't do, and certainly a lot of those barriers have been removed over the years, but it was very clear, I think, to me that it was more than just the structural barriers. That was just kind of the part that was very easy to see. It's like, oh, so women can't serve on these ships, or they can't serve in direct ground combat, or they can't serve in aircraft. And those things, of course, have all been lifted. But it was more than that. It was more about that they weren't seen as peers, as equals, in many variety of different ways, and treated that way. And it was a lot of those same inequities that we found, of course, in a variety of different professions and industries that tend to have you know, again, a very male dominated, historically male industry or profession out there. And there's still lots of those today as well. And that a lot of the things that we learned along the way were great application into, again, a variety of different industries and professions.
So let me ask you a question. Your wife was a U.S. Naval officer, and I have no idea your own vintage, but how rare is that today, and how rare was it when she first became an officer that you had a woman naval officer?
Good question. So when we started our careers, we both went to the Naval Academy, and we're both graduates in the class of 1987. So we were there in the early 80s when, you know, the first class of women was 1980. So it was very small percentage, less than 10% of the classes when we were there had women in them. So very, very small group, very small opportunities as well to serve and to find long-lasting careers. That all shifted and changed over the decades after that. But at the time, that was very different in terms of, again, how they could serve and the number of women. There weren't a lot. So that has shifted and changed today. And of course, it's been a slow progression. And certainly the military today is upwards, pushing up closer to, you know, 20% overall of women in that are serving today. And at the Naval Academy where Brad teaches, they're reaching up into 30% women now. And that's one of the major accession sources for officers into the Navy and the Marine Corps. So that, of course, will begin to populate, and those will continue to increase.
Fascinating. So take a moment, and Brad, why don't you start on this? Tell us about the book you've authored, when it came out, and tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Yeah, happy to, Scott. So this is the second book Dave and I have written together. Our first book, Athena Rising, was all about men becoming better mentors. And we found ourselves getting pulled into these broader conversations after Athena Rising about just, you know, broadly, how can men show up in the workplace as more effective allies for women to really move the dial on gender inclusion, gender equity, and you know, men we found were often on the sidelines kind of wondering, how do I enter in? My heart's in the right place. I care about women, you know, in my personal life and professional life. I'm just not sure it's my place, right, to enter in, and I'm not sure what to do in very behavioral terms. So we initiated a two-year qualitative study interviewing lots of women across professions and asking them, have you had experience with men who you would call real allies in the workplace, and what do they do? You know, Dave and I are all about the behavior. We're social scientists. We're not interested as much in aspiration. We're interested in real execution of allyship. So we heard from all these women what guys did that really made a difference and convinced them that these guys, you know, earned the distinction of being called an ally. So we put all that together. In many cases, these women nominated a male who they viewed as a really significant ally, and we got to interview a lot of those gentlemen as well. And so our book is really kind of taking both the best evidence already, you know, empirically about what allyship looks like, and then, you know, dovetailing that with the voices of women that we got to interview. And we really wanted to turn this into a tool guide, you know, kind of a roadmap for men about how to show up both personally and publicly as an ally for women in the workplace.
And so talk about for a moment, what are some of the things that women cite that men actually do to be good mentors or sponsors? What are some of the things you hear in your discussions?
Yeah, so there's a lot, and we have a whole book full of that in particular. But let me just hit a couple of the top ones. And it's interesting, the number one skill set in particular that women most appreciated and their male mentors, and the one that in some cases they wish their mentors were better at in some cases, was that they're just being good listeners. And so they would tell us a little bit more about what do they mean exactly about being good listeners. Well, it was listening with the intent to learn. Like this uses the trait of humility in particular, and women talked about this in terms of cultural or gender humility. In other words, you know, that you're not a guy and maybe you haven't walked a mile in a woman's shoes. So why, you know, why would you expect that you would understand everything about her experiences in the workplace? And so if we approach the relationship with a learning orientation, the intent to learn about, she has some, you know, I'm going to learn about her experiences, and that's going to make me a better mentor, because now I can help her in terms of different types of career guidance, or helping to understand some of the barriers or challenges and how we can address some of those along the way. But really having that listening set was really important. And it wasn't, it was also really important to women, I think, that the men listened to learn, and not what they, we see a lot of times as leaders, I think, in mentors, is that they pride themselves in being great problem solvers. And I think a lot of us do. But, and, you know, when it comes to mentoring in particular, problem solving isn't necessarily what we're trying to accomplish there. Sometimes people just need to be affirmed, and they need to be heard and affirmed that, yes, you belong. Yes, they didn't make a mistake when they hired you. Yes, there's a future and a career path and a path forward for advancing in this organization. And, you know, we as, I think in particular as majority white men, often we take that for granted, that the workplace is designed for us and there is a place for us, because we look all around us and we see lots of great role models out there of people who are, you know, doing blazing trails out there. And women, and women of color, and again, other groups may look around and say, yeah, not so much for me. And so sometimes as mentors and as sponsors, we need to be affirming that people belong. And so we need to listen, not just with the intent to solve a problem. And then when we finally hear what the problem is, go, aha, now I can fix your problem. That's not necessarily our role as mentors. Again, sometimes we can facilitate and provide resources or coping strategies or mastery skills to help them overcome some of these challenges, but it's not necessarily our role to fix some sort of problem that women may have. The other one is we have to be careful, and I think women most appreciated this in their male mentors, that men, these men were not trying to fix them either, right, to adapt them or change them in some way to pretzel themselves into this mold of what a masculine workplace and a masculine leadership style and all these things that guys typically do, but appreciate them for, again, their own unique set of skills and the strengths that they bring to the organization that make us all better. So listening was certainly one of the top skills, and with that was around humility. The other one was providing the same kind of challenge, and an opportunity comes with that as well. And so as it turned out, you know, in some cases, you know, women, it's like, you know, we don't want to be coddled. We don't want to be treated differently. We need to have the same opportunities to make mistakes, to fail, to grow and develop along the way that men are getting, because if we don't, we're not going to get the same access and to get to do the same things. And so a lot of times, again, these men were really good about making sure that they would challenge them in a variety of different ways to do this growth that's so important. And when they understood the opportunities that they needed to grow, the next steps in their careers, they would help provide that. But they didn't make assumptions about what those next steps were. They didn't try to, we often see this in mentoring, where men may try to clone their mentee to look like them, say, hey, this is what worked for me, you should do the same. Well, maybe I don't want to do exactly what you did, or maybe it doesn't make sense in this new, maybe the workplace has changed, or maybe things have shifted in our industry now, and I need to look at things a little bit differently, or maybe my work family setup, my interaction is all different than yours. And so I need a different combination of opportunities and skill sets to succeed in who I am personally. So they treat them as individuals and really provided the same opportunities and challenges to grow that they did for other men.
Fantastic, and thank you. Brad, let me ask you a follow-up question to this issue. And again, David says very well that so much of it is trying to avoid some natural instincts, trying to solve problems and just listen and affirm. People can solve their own problems often, but if you try and force your solution on them, people can't stand that generally. So more listening and affirming and well thought, well stated, Dave. Brad, some of your thoughts on trends you're seeing in women's leadership. Love to hear about them in broader society as a whole, and also in the U.S. Naval Academy, because what fascinating things to look at and observe on. Any thoughts on trends in women's leadership?
So again, this is something that Dave actually does a lot of research on. You know, one of the things that comes from our research is, you know, and part of the messaging that Dave just alluded to for men in particular is the trend that when you really look at what the leadership behaviors are that most people in the workplace are attracted to, what you find are some very consistent things. So I love to work for a leader who is more relational, who is more egalitarian, who is more inclusive, who is a bit more democratic when it comes to decision making, somebody who communicates real care for me as an employee or a follower. And when you look at the broad gender and leadership research, lo and behold, what you find is that women often are far ahead of men in many of those categories. And, you know, so if we just think about more traditionally feminine approaches to leadership, people, when they look at the behavior, say, yeah, that's who I want to work for. So a big piece of our messaging for men really gets back to what Dave mentioned, that, man, if you want your company or your organization to do well, you have to challenge your implicit assumptions, which are sometimes unconscious, about what great leadership looks like. And what we're finding is it's not the old command and control, hierarchical, top-down approach that men have been much more comfortable with for years. And if we promote that kind of leadership, we're actually doing our organization a disservice. So, you know, the research at this point, Scott, is just absolutely inarguable that when you have more women in more leadership roles till you get to real gender balance, those companies make more money, they're more competitive, they're more geared for the long term. And that's something that men, you know, Dave and I included, have got to become more aware of.
Dave, let me have you comment on this as well. I mean, there's great data on this, what Brad said, that companies are more inclusive of women leadership and often women-led do better from a profit and revenues perspective than do often men-led companies. And even besides that, the point on this former concept of what a leader looks like, sort of, you know, cut and pasted from the you know, a patrician-looking person, that's really a former view of what leadership looks like today. It no longer has to be this middle-aged to elderly patrician-looking guy, and often the better leaders are not, but they're of all types and sorts. Dave, you want to take a moment to comment?
Yeah, absolutely, and there's so much here with this, and let me just give you a couple pieces. So some recent research on a team that I'm on, we're still working on the second part of the study right now, but the first part was really looking at in ways that we can find how these biased perspectives of how leadership is perceived, how that impacts people in terms of a variety of different employment processes. And so we went and we had the opportunity to look at the subjective language used in performance evaluations. And this is from a leadership perspective. So our team analyzed that, and it's interesting, you know, obviously, we would expect in a perfect world there wouldn't be any gender difference, right, between the subjective language used in a performance evaluation, but there is. There are all kinds of significant differences, and so we find that, you know, men, no surprise, get more positive or what we would call descriptive language of what we think a leader is. They get more positive language in their traits and descriptors of how they're described. As leaders, women get more negative, right, proscriptive of what a leader shouldn't be and how they shouldn't act. And so that's just one from a more quantitative perspective, but from a subjective perspective. So the language they actually get in their performance evaluations are very different. And so the number one, for example, positive descriptor or trait for men was analytical in our sample. And that's a great trait to have, and I think everybody would appreciate that, no matter what your profession is. But for women, the number one trait was compassionate. And again, you look at that and you go, wow, you know, that's something that I would appreciate in a leader, no matter what the industry or profession is. They're both great, right? But do they have a, what could they make a difference from an employment process about who's advanced, who's promoted, who gets an opportunity, who gets hired, right? So if you're a hiring manager, you got to make a decision. You got person A, we know that their number one trait is analytical. Person B, number one trait is compassionate. Who do you hire? It's interesting. A lot of people will defer to the, I want the analytical person. But we know from international studies, global studies, that people most value and they would like to see more of the trait of compassion or compassionate. And so it's really kind of paradoxical in terms of how we say, we make decisions based off of this, but we say we want this other aspect. And so it's really interesting. And on the negative side, the number one negative trait that men received was arrogant. And the number one trait that women received was inept. So back to, being penalized for competence, perceived competence. And again, if you're making an employment decision of some sort, so in this case, you got to fire somebody. Do you fire person A who's arrogant or person B who's inept? And often like, well, we can deal with the arrogance, so I fire the inept person. So we can have an effect. And these are very subtle differences as you look at them, but they're significant, statistically significant in the research that we do. So there's a whole host of these. Again, they're implicit biases or unconscious biases that, again, affect employment processes, but you don't know to look for them unless you're aware of them. And this is one of the key messages that we come out with in Good Guys, is that as men and as managers and as leaders, no matter what level you're at, we have to have a better awareness and understanding of how these everyday practices, and this is, we're just talking about the employment process, period. I mean, it applies across the board when it comes to benefits and pay and everything that's important to us. We have to be aware of how these things happen and how they affect people. Because if we don't know to look for them. And if we don't know to look for them, guess what? They continue to perpetuate themselves over time. And so important that men begin to understand other people's experiences and how these inequities are created, and then how to look for them so that we can go out there and root them out. Because for the most part, the men that we talk to are all about gender equity, gender equality, because they want it for their key family members, the women in their lives. They want it for their female colleagues at work. They just don't know where to start and where to begin. And this is one of the places we need to start because it makes a difference in the workplace.
Well, fantastic. Brad and Dave, what a great pleasure to visit with you. And what a fascinating life's work you've ended up with coming out of the U.S. Navy College, U.S. Navy War College, U.S. Naval Academy. Really fascinating and great work that you're doing. Can you tell us one more time the name of the book and where people can find the book so our listeners can hear that? Thank you. Brad or Dave?
Yeah, so this is Brad, and you can find Good Guys, How Men Can Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace, on Amazon or any place else that you get your books. It's published with Harvard Business Review, and it launches on October 13th, but it's available for pre-order right now.
Fantastic. Brad and Dave, thank you for the work you do. And what a great pleasure to visit with you today on the Becker Group Women's Leadership Podcast and the Scott Becker Business Podcast. What a pleasure. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Scott, for having us.